Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miċjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba tal-Bank of Valletta. Campus FM jippreżenta Mhux kelma bejn tnejn, l-intervista tal-Bank of Valletta. Jippreżentaw il-program Father Joe Borge u l-Professur Joe Pirotta.
Jien, Father Joe Borge nkien, ma tħabibtiet, Professur Joe Pirotta nistennilkom għall-programm ieħor. Il-mistiden tagħna llum huwa Ahmed Zania Bugri mill-Ghana, imma ċittadin Malti bħalna. Huwa ilu snin issa u Malta. Naraw ma kif mil-Ghana ġi Malta u għala mil-Ghana kif spiċċa f'dal-pajjiż. Għadu student, studja Malta, għadu student tal-liġi, ma jiggradwa bħala avukat din is-sena. Huwa pastor mal-Knisja Pentekostali u koli ċermen tal-Kunsill tal-Knisja Pentekostali f'Malta u center manager tal-Open Center fil-Marsa. Ġifieri, ma' Ahmed żgur li ħansibu ħafna affarijiet fuq xiex nitkellmu kemm fuq il-ħajja tiegħu biex insiru nafu aħjar, imma anki waħda mis-suġġetti naturalment huma fid-diskussjoni il-preżenza f'Malta ta' dan ta' tant immigranti, uħud refuġjati, uħud immigranti illegali, nipprova nitlu ftit tal-Marsa Open Center jaraw il-Maltin u għaddejjin isuqu minn dik in-naħa, kultant tara ħafna ħwejjeġ imdan lin mat-twieqi kultant tisma xi ħaġa, anke kien hemm xi protesti kontri wkoll li ġifieri naraw daw x'kienu għaliex. U anke nixtiequ mbagħad nidħlu ftit ukoll fuq il-Knisja Pentekostali f'Malta. Jekk kif l-istess kandidat il-Knisja Pentekostali f'Malta u l-Knisja Kristjana Evanġelika għax daw qegħdin it-tnejn fis-sebu tiegħu naraw ftit x'inhuma. So welcome you to our program, Ahmed. Ahmed Zani Bugri from Ghana. Let's start with you as a person.
Yes.
Your name. What does it mean?
Oh, thank you, Father Joe, and thank you for Father Pirotta. Obviously, my name signifies where I come from and how I was born. I was born into a Muslim family, So I did not start my life as a Christian, which is another whole story that probably I will be able to introduce to you. Mm-hmm. But I am the youngest of 9 children born. I am born in a town in the northern part of Ghana, which is a town which is a border between Burkina Faso and Togo. It's called Boku. It is, if you go about 5 kilometers, you are in Burkina Faso. If you go to your left 3 kilometers, you are in Togo. So my paternal grandmother comes from Burkina Faso, and my maternal grandfather comes from Togo. So I can claim the nationality of these 3 countries, but I was born and raised in Ghana, in this town, so I took over. So I am a Ghanaian by birth.
And Maltese by choice.
Yes, a Maltese by choice and through marriage, which is one of the ways by which a person can become a Maltese citizen at the moment. But I think that it was not the marriage which made me a Maltese, but it was the choice to become a Maltese citizen since I arrived here.
Let's take it bit by bit.
There's something very interesting what he has just said about growing up in this border town. Would you agree with me then that I seem to picture you as a clear example of the territorial lines drawn across peoples in Africa to create the, countries that the colonialists needed to create for their own interests?
Yes, and I think I happen to be fortunate when it comes to issues of multiculturalism or growing in a town which is divided for political reasons. For example, in my town at the moment where I was born, there's actually a conflict going on because of these border divisions. As you know, Togo used to be part of the Transvolta, and then it was divided and became Togo. So we grew up not I did not call myself a Ghanaian. I called myself by my tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And that is my identity.
And your tribe is?
My tribe is the Mampusi tribe. Now, I take my father's tribe. My mother is a Kusasi. And my father is a Mampusi. Now, these two tribes are at loggerheads with each other. They're fighting and killing each other. My grandmother is a Moshi. So you can see that my roots come from three major tribes who live in three different countries, but who, before the colonial British came, was one clan, was one people, neighbors who married, who had an identity of a kingdom. So we speak of the Mampusi kingdom. We speak of the Kusasi kingdom, we speak of the Moshi kingdom, but not Ghana, Burkina Faso, or Togo. And so you grow up as a child having this identity of where you come from, and that's where tribal markings, you know, as you can see my face, comes from, because it was a key identity issue.
Those markings on your face were artificial?
No, these ones. An accident. But you grow up identifying yourself with your father's tribe.
And wouldn't you say this is one of the lingering problems in Africa, that people tend to identify themselves primarily with their people? I hate the word tribe, because tribe actually is another derogatory word for nation.
Okay?
With their nation, rather than the new nation, the political nation.
Yes. I happen to read a bit of history, and I have realized that the nationhood is a recent creation by Europeans. And in Africa, the concept of a nation is still a new notion, is still a new idea. People identify themselves, yes, as you said, by their peoples. I am a Mampusi. I come from the Mampusi tribe. Although I will go to school with you, you are from the Kusasi tribe or Moshi or Hausa. I speak about 8 different languages just from one town. And each person will identify himself with his people, although he can speak a common language with every other person. So we had to speak English when we were in school. But when we had Ghanaian languages taught, they will teach all the major languages of my town and also all the major religions, because we have no common religion and we have no common language. So you could not say this person is a Ghanaian or this person a Ghanaian. So we took English as a common factor. So when it came to elections, you would speak English. Or the election system, even in Ghana at the moment as I speak, has been divided into peoples. And that is still causing conflict, because if I align myself with this political party, it means that the other peoples who want the power to control their kingdom will align themselves with the other party. So Ghana has somehow succeeded in diffusing people conflict, if I may use that word, the word tribal, which I've been used to, by at least coming to a compromise that if the president is from the south or is an Ashanti man, then the vice president must come from the north and must be a Muslim. So if you have a Muslim president, you have to have a Christian vice president.
Balance and counterbalance.
And so you have a balance and counterbalance. And then you also have a regional house of chiefs and national house of chiefs, which become an advisory body to the government. So you have got all these kingdoms and all these people's interests being taken care of.
And the chiefs are not elected, I guess.
No, the chiefs are not elected. The chiefs are by gates. So
by
a gate system. A gate system is a family name. Like the Buguri family is a gate. So, actually, the chieftaincy of Boko was, I come from the royal family. So, if my father's gate has the chieftaincy this time, when he dies, then a different gate, which is maybe an uncle, which is maybe a cousin.
Gate, you mean? G-A-T-E?
Yes. We call them gates because each gate is simple. It's a clan.
Okay.
But a clan can be a different, you know, person. You have one ancestry, but with different children. So my grandfather, for example, he was the paramount chief of the Mampusi kingdom in Ghana or in Boko, and he had 20 wives. So if I say my family, I mean, when I took my wife to Ghana and my children, and they met their cousins. There were hundreds of them, and they said, "Who is my cousin?" I said, "All of them are your cousins, because my grandfather had 10 wives. Yeah. He was the chief." So the
way, if you have to buy presents for your cousins, then it would be,
well, we don't buy presents, yeah, exactly. You know. So, and that is why, that is one reason why many Africans find it difficult to go back home, because mm-hmm. the expectation to get a gift for everyone in your family is so large that what, who would you give and who would you leave out? So when I talk about a family, I don't talk about an immediate nucleus family. Uh-huh. I talk about my uncle's children and all their family. So okay. Each gate is your ancestral line.
Okay, so your grandfather had 20 wives.
Yes.
Your father had 10 wives.
No, my father happened to have three wives.
Three wives only?
Yes.
Oh, poor man.
And I have one.
And you have one. So,
so.
Yeah, but you told us that you were brought up in a Muslim family, and yes. then you became Christian.
Yes.
How did that happen?
As the youngest of my family, as the youngest of the nine children, I was one of the young people who had a curiosity for learning since my younger age. I had an uncle who studied in Yugoslavia. He became a doctor, so I went to live with him for a while. And I think that the curiosity of learning...
In Yugoslavia, at yes. the time of Tito, I guess.
I don't know, but he was an Olympian. He used to... He was a sport... Mm-hmm. He was with the Ghana
Olympic team.
Yes, mm-hmm. team, Sambugri. And so whenever he came home, I mean, he was a doctor, he was the head of the UN, mm-hmm. you know, in Ghana. So somehow, as a child, I took him as a model. Mm-hmm. When I went to live with him, I was exposed to Christians. Now, when I went back home, my family are very, very Islamic. I mean, I'm the only Christian in my family. And when I went to secondary school, I was very much involved in the students' movement of the Ghana Muslim Students Union. I was even the secretary in my school and in my region. So you enter into debate with Christians as to who Muhammad is, as to who Jesus is. And there was, and I mean, in Islam, Jesus is a prophet and nothing else. He cannot be compared with God in any way because of the Quranic mm-hmm. scriptures. Mm-hmm. Allahu ahad, Allahu samad, walam yalid, walam yulad, lam yakun lahu kufuwan ahad. So I had a difficulty identifying Jesus with God. Mm-hmm. And there was this lady in my class who used to say, "Look, you know, Jesus is God." She was actually a Pentecostal. Mm-hmm. I had no idea at that time the Christian divisions and denominations and stuff. So one day, she invited me to a Christian group meeting.
How old were you at that time?
I was in secondary school. I was in boarding school. Okay. Just my last year of sixth form. Mm-hmm. So she said, "Let me try my life, probably I got to know." So she invited me. She said, "Look, Ahmed, you have to come to our meetings and you have to see what we do." And I wanted just to go out of curiosity, but also I was a very ardent student of Ahmed Didat, one of the Muslim scholars mm-hmm. from South Africa. He died now. And I read this book, Crucifixion or Crucifixion. I mean, he changes the X into a T, and it kind of intrigued me that Jesus actually was not crucified, but it was a resemblance of Judas at the time. And I had heard also the talk of Louis Farrakhan, who had gone to Libya, and he was, at that time, Ghana was in a revolution with Rawlings, and so we're very revolutionary. So I went there actually to challenge these people and say, "Look, Jesus is not actually crucified, but it was the resemblance of Judas." But when I went to this meeting, this Christian meeting, first they were praying and shouting as Pentecostals do, and I just stood at the back. But what really touched me was one of them gave a testimony of a healing. And I said, "Okay, this is where I will challenge whether this Christianity is true or not." Now, I used to stammer really, really badly. I could not speak the way I spoke. And for some reason, I challenged them. You know, I challenged Kezia, her name was. I said, "Look, if this your Jesus is able to heal me, I'll become a Christian." That was, I don't know whether I said it out of bluff or I was very sincere. Somehow I was a bit sincere that, if something could happen to this girl, it might happen to me. And 3 days later, my friend of mine realized that I wasn't stammering with difficulty as I used to stammer. And for the first time, I had a personal encounter, not with a religious Christianity, but with a miraculous encounter. And that really confused me. What also was difficult was that we had, and that's how I ended up in Malta, we had a missionary who was a Maltese missionary, and he was a Catholic charismatic priest, and so...
You remember his name?
Yes, he's here. Mm-hmm. He is Father Victor De Gabriele. Mm-hmm. He's now living at the Saria. Mm-hmm. So, but before we met with this person, I went to the guardian and counseling teacher. It became a big thing because I was well known. My father is an imam. Mm-hmm. So it was well known that I had gone to Christian meeting, that I was claiming that I have a miracle. And they explained to me what had happened in the Bible. So I began to read the Bible. For the first time, I read the Bible.
Okay, so, but how did your family react to it?
Are you a renegade there?
It was difficult. First, I had a visit with my cousin, that they have heard what had happened, and tried to persuade me to deny what had happened. It was in May, and we had our A-levels in June, May-June. It was around that time, so April, May, June. When I had that visit, I knew that something was serious. So I stepped back, but there was this nagging feeling. And the Christian group at that time, the Scripture Union group at that time, really gave me support. Mm-hmm. They came, they gave me a Bible, they were so excited, they told me they're praying for me. And I think that support that I got from the Christian group distinguished them from the persecution that I got from the Muslim group. Because suddenly my friends really became sort of like my enemies. They did not talk to me. All they did was threaten me.
And your family.
And my family was very quiet at that time. But the visit of my cousin showed me that if I went back home, I mean, my father was so respectful that he wouldn't come to the school. So it was very quiet. When I went back home from school and I put my trunk down. I remember I was wearing a black, a light blue shirt and a khaki trousers. My family, they lined up. There were seven men, my father included, all the elders of my family, and they put me in the middle. And they asked me, we heard what had happened. That was almost 2 months. Now you have one choice. Either your family or the Christians. I don't recollect what happened, but I just started crying and I said, look, I speak well. I love my family, but I speak well and I cannot deny that something had happened. And I remember my father pointing a finger at me and telling me, if you don't stop speaking this rubbish, if you die, you'll be like a vulture. Now that was a language of disowning me. And he got up and he left. And my uncle told me, get out and leave here. So I left. It was
and
out
where
of...
Where did you go?
I went, first of all, to the pastor's house. I went to the nearest church, which was a Pentecostal church, Assembly of God church. And I was confused, and I told him what had happened, and they took care of me. So from that day, I began to live with different Christian families. So I have been to literally any church. I've been to a Baptist church, I've been to a Pentecostal church, I've been to a Roman Catholic church. Then I had always wanted to be an imam. The last family which adopted me were actually Roman Catholic Charismatic. And so I began to work with the Catholic Action Youth Movement in Ghana. I became very, very active. So I left my town and I went to Kumasi.
Was it ICP?
It was through ICP I came here.
Because ICP is a Maltese movement.
Yes, so it was through ICP I finally ended up in Malta because I was so active. When ICP came to Ghana the first time, our bishop recommended that I would come to Malta. So that is how I ended up. I came to an ICP Youth School of Evangelization.
In Malta?
Yes, in 1990.
But that's a Catholic school, isn't it?
Yes, it was a Catholic evangelizing school. I stayed 1 year extra to train as a staff. In fact, I worked with quite a few youth groups in Kalkara, you know, especially in St. Paul's Bay.
At the time, I think they used to meet at San Martin. They used to live in San
Martin. Yes,
so
yes.
Very nice
surroundings. Oh, yes, it was my first introduction to Malta was actually San Martin.
Okay, namlu pausa qasira wara din il-pausa. Paw magħna nkomplu nitkellmu ma' Aħmed Zanja Bugri u forsi anki issa naqbdu suġġetti oħrajn mill-ħajja interessanti li għandu.
Tkun xi tkun it-triq li tagħżel matul ħajtek, aħna nistgħu ngħinuk tfassal pjan finanzjarju li jaqdi l-ħtiġijiet tiegħek. Kellimna issa Bank of Valletta. Impenn lejn is-suċċess tiegħek. Il-Bank of Valletta huwa l-liċenzjat sabiex jipprovdi servizzi ta' investiment mill-MFSA.
Lura l-programm jinfadel Joe Borch flimkien mal-Professur Joe Perotta qegħdin nintervistaw il-Aħmed Zanja Bugri. Let's leave the religion part aside for the moment, but I would like to return to it and discuss a little bit the presence
of... Father Borch leads the religious side. That's interesting.
For the moment, I said.
Okay.
And let's look at another side of your career, because now you are the center manager for the Marsa Open Center. And let's talk, before zeroing in or on the Marsa Open Center, about this phenomenon, which for many Maltese is a problem. Many people, generally people from Africa, come to Malta. I think most people would prefer them not to be here. Many people will say, while they are here, we'll help them, but we'll help them to keep on going somewhere else. And some people would also be hostile, have a very negative attitude. How do you look at this phenomenon? Because this is a kind of multiculturalism, which is different from the multiculturalism that you are speaking of, because the different nations or tribes there, or whatever you call them, peoples, used to live there, were living there together. Sometimes fighting, but living in the same area. But people tell you here that this is a kind of multiculturalism which is being forced upon us from the outside. How do you react?
Again, I take this subject from a very personal point of view. My first encounter with African migrants in Malta came in early 2002. I had just come back from studying in Belgium. I had worked in Belgium, which is in Brussels, which is a very multicultural city. And when I came here, I was very oblivious to any African presence, because when I came here in the early 1990s, there were very, very few Africans. You could count probably about five of us. And I remember we used to go to the port, to the Grand Harbor, to wait for the ship to come from Libya and to be able to welcome people and to be able to at least see black people and to go and cook something African and to talk something familiar. Mm-hmm. But in 2002, the issue of African migrants in Malta was brought to my attention by two Congolese young people who heard about our church and had heard about me, and they came to speak with me, and they said, look, we want a place to pray. And I said, where are you from Congo? And they said, there are many African people at the moment, and they are in detention. And I go, where is detention? They told me Safi, Alfar. So I said, well, if there are African people here, I can help. So initially I got contact with people who are African migrants to help, but also to see their situation for myself. And I immediately realized the problems that they faced were problems I was very familiar with. Number one, people who had finished school and they could not find any stable employment. Number two,
in their country.
In their countries. Number two, rural-urban migration, which was a topic that I knew when I was in secondary school. The cities were becoming fuller and the villages were being emptied. and at some point people could not sustain themselves in the city, so they became a very good target for people smugglers and traffickers. The third thing is conflict, tribal conflict, which, at least with my legal understanding now, is not recognized as something that qualifies for a refugee status under the international convention. But nonetheless, tribal conflict moves people. In Ghana, if I move from the north to the south, I'm a foreigner, complete foreigner. I have to learn a new language, I have to learn a new culture, and they see me as a foreigner. Because, again, in Ghana, there is no, there's a Ghanaian when we are doing elections. There's a Ghanaian when we have national football or World Cup. Apart from this big phenomenon, we have our own people. So, for me, from the north, coming to live in Malta, or coming to live in Germany, or living down in Accra, is the same for me. So, people move where they can find a future. And when I saw most of these young people, some of them from my own town, and some of them from my own region, and I could speak here their language, and I asked them, why did you move? And most of them were coming from Libya, where they had left Ghana during the revolution time, and they had gone to Libya to find work as teachers, as laborers. But then when Gaddafi was trying to look to the west, then Africans became persona non grata. So I took a trip to Libya myself, and I met with the ambassador, who happened at that time, fortunately, to be a cousin. And so
the ambassador
of Ghana to Malta and Libya. You know, that he was here personally, and so he had invited me to go to Libya. And the conditions of most of these people in Libya was very, very pathetic. I mean, they lived in open buildings, they worked, and they were not paid. So
the Jesuits published a book, I guess you must have seen it. Even the conditions, some of them are imprisoned, and then they pay to get out. But then they take the money from them, and they do not let them out.
All these stories, I can confirm that they are true. Well, some of them might be exaggerated, but it is true. I have been to a Libyan detention center, and when I went there, I wept. The conditions under which African young people live. I myself, in Tripoli, I was refused to buy a tie in a shop because I was black. I went to a shop.
So the conditions in detention centers in Malta are very good compared to Libya?
Comparatively.
Yeah, compared to Libya, I said.
Yes, because at least here, it was overcrowding because of numbers. But I think in Libya it's also coupled with the treatment that you are not, once you're not Libyan in Libya, you are less of a human being. And I can say that because I personally have had even my Maltese passport seized at the airport.
In Libya?
In Libya. So these people were moving because of personal reasons. And that is what touched me.
If I were to ask you a question from another viewpoint, if, speaking to me as a Maltese, who for this particular moment I'm donning the hat of seeing all immigrants as unwelcome, how would you persuade me of the need for these people to be here?
I think.
Yeah, but do they want to be here?
I would say 98%, 99% of the people who are here in Malta did not intend to come here and do not want to be here. But it can be attributed to a number of factors. First of all, when most African migrants came here, we have a mandatory detention policy. So when a person arrives in your place and is detained, the person is saying, I feel unwelcome. And as we have said before, it is a fact that when the numbers began to increase every time, detention became overcrowded. The open centers became overcrowded. So the conditions of an overcrowded detention place with the soldiers and these people frustrated, traumatized, Malta did not have the the know-how, the capacity, the place to handle these. So in the initial stages between 2004 and 2004, it was very, very difficult, both for the authorities and for the migrants, and all the riots and noises. So people felt we are not wanted. Secondly, most of these people did not understand what asylum is. Because if I came in the same boat with a Somali, with an Eritrean, mm-hmm. the law allows the Somali to have protection. If I am coming from northern Ghana or from Ivory Coast, for where I was moved because of conflict, and it's reported that there was the north and the south of Ivory Coast was divided into two, and people were being pursued in their own family houses and being killed. If I found my way all the way to Libya and I crossed here, the law does not grant me protection. So I become disgruntled. Why are you choosing only a Somali and not me? We came on the same boat, we paid the same money to cross. So why do you single me out as not being a person who is worthy of protection? So there was a legal misunderstanding of what a refugee is. The second thing is the future of a person. Where, if I live in Malta 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, do I ever have the chance of becoming a citizen? And the answer is no. You know, as you said, the perception is that we can help African migrants in Malta to recover, but they should move on. That itself is a rejection of the person.
But can you see a reason for it?
Yes. As a Maltese society, even living here, Maltese react to things which are new. It can be politics, it can be discussion on divorce, as we are struggling with now. But I think that when people begin to understand the situation, they accept. I mean, I have lived here for 20 years. I feel Maltese. My neighbors accept me fully, but they've had to take time to accept me as Ahmed. Mm-hmm. They've known my character. They've known how I deal with things. And this is people's concern in the villages. I don't know this person. I don't know where he's coming from. I don't know his background. Is he a criminal? All these questions is what makes racist fear in people. And as people begin to understand that most of these people, most, I wouldn't say all, are people genuinely in need, their reactions have changed. I have seen many, many Maltese come to Mass Open Center and assist migrants. I mean, they would find them jobs, they would do things for them. And I have had to invite people to say, come to Mass Open Center. Have you ever been in the Open Center? And then they say no. And I said, come and visit. They come. For example, you know, the first day Kenneth came to Mass Open Center was his first day. I think it was a shock. Mm-hmm. I can see people's faces. Why? Because when you see a building with a concentration of black people, it does shock you. I even had the same shock when I went to Maso Open Center the first time. But the moment you begin to go around and begin to talk to people and begin to hear their stories, you would see that there are human beings behind these stories.
Yes, true, Ahmed. Yes, true, no problem.
And that these people are different. And so I, who was afraid before, become sympathetic.
Okay, but let me tell you some reactions.
Yes.
Soldiers working with the migrants in the detention center, decent Maltese people. One of them was telling me I used to bring clothes to them, my own clothes, which I was still wearing, which were still good, and they would throw them back in my face, telling me, but these are not, they do not have a good brand. Treating the soldiers, that is, in an aggressive manner. So you find stories of Maltese who wanted to help, and they were rejected, or they were hurt.
It's true. Look, again, many people did not see the position from where these people are coming from. The mm-hmm. average journey that a person takes to come to reach Malta takes about 4 or 5 years. He has had to leave his home, a traumatic situation, had to cross the desert, smuggled, pay people, sometimes drink his own urine, to get to Libya. He made it out of one person making it. The stories are that 5, 6, 7 people have died. He saw his own friends die in front of him. He sometimes carried them. I have stories of people carrying each other, even photos of their friends dying in their own hands. Traumatic experiences. They come to Libya. They have to work in construction sites, plaster houses, not paid. They have to sew the money in their clothes to save enough money to take the boat. Sometimes they try 4, 5 times before they can make it. They cross the sea sometimes 4 days, 5 days, 6 days. They are traumatized. They come here, they are detained. So the person is just fed up with anything. The soldiers were not trained. The detention services people were not trained to handle traumatized people. In fact, right now we're training detention officers. Some of us had to go in UNHCR, including myself, had to go and tell people, look, you have to approach this person as a person who knows nothing about your culture. So take him from step one without being disrespectful. Tell him, this is a toilet. You sit on the toilet. After that, you flush it. And then you clean it. You don't say to him, now, today you are going to clean, and he doesn't know it. And he will not tell you, I don't know it. So the education process of a person leaving one culture and entering into another culture with a different perception. People thought, when I go to Europe, I am going to get employment from the first day. I am going to have money in my pocket. I am going to start wearing designer clothes like I find in the films. But it's a different story. Now, these stories of designer clothes is exaggerated, and I can tell you that. It is, I work in the place. If you come to Maso Open Center today, and then you ask someone, do you have water? He will tell you, no, we don't have water here. We have no water. The place is dirty. The first time I went to Maso Open Center to work, we had repaired a toilet and a bathroom. The next day, it was reported in the news by an Italian journalist, these same toilets. They had gone to literally call the journalists who were looking for sensational stories. They defecated in these toilets, and they called the journalists to come and take the photos in the night because they wanted to shame the government and to put the pressure for the government to give them papers to move on. So, behind all these stories of riots
riots against you. So, exactly. And you are one of them. You are trained.
But you have to see why. When I went into Maso Open Center, someone told me this one time. He told me, Ahmed, you don't have the mind of an immigrant. You have to acquire one. And I asked him, what do you mean? And he told me, you have to learn. We have had to live double lives. 90% of those who say that their name is called Abdallah are called Isaac. So they've had to change their whole identity in order to get protection. And a person who has changed his identity does not want to be recognized. But it's all coming from the traumatic experiences and the fear of having to be sent back. In the instance of the demonstration against me, it was simply because when I went into Maso Open Center, the center was run by migrants. There was no gate. Everyone came in, they went out, and I said, I can't take this because if something happens, I feel responsible as the manager of the center. So I have suggested to government to put a gate. Now, for the ones who had been there, who were powerful, who used the others to make money clandestinely and to control the place, to put a gate meant that we transferred the control from them to an administration for which they didn't like.
Damn lupa ussa asira ankom fi diskussjoni ta' nwar din il-qasa.
Tkun xi tkun it-triq li tagħżel matul ħajtek, aħna nistgħu ngħinuk tfassal pjan finanzjarju li jaqdi l-ħtiġijiet tiegħek. Kellimna issa Bank of Valletta. Impenn lejn is-suċċess tiegħek. Il-Bank of Valletta huwa licenzjat sabiex jipprovdi servizzi ta' investiment mill-MFSA.
Ahmed, one of the concerns that we often hear from Maltese about these immigrants is health problems. The fear that they're coming from a continent, especially which is which has a number of tropical diseases which were unknown in Malta, and also from a continent which is rife with AIDS and HIV. From your own experience, how substantial in reality do you feel these fears are?
Again, one of the benefits, if I might say so, it is difficult for me to say that detention has been beneficial. But one of the benefits of the multi-detention policy has been that it has acted as a sieve for these mm-hmm. things. Because before a person is released from detention into the community, he will have a certified health bill. Nobody is released into the Maltese community unless he is certified by a doctor that he is fit to live in Malta. So people are screened for tuberculosis, for HIV, for hepatitis, all these things which people suspect that will happen. And it's true, because Malta is a small country. With one epidemic, it catches everybody. So for the people who leave detention and come into an open center, they are people who have been treated completely. And so the concern of health, I can say that statistically, and I don't know much, but I can tell you from my experience, at the Massa Open Center, we do not have any person there who poses as a health risk. The highest that we have got is for a person to have scabies. Mm-hmm. And that, once we see it, they isolate it and they treat it, and within 1 week the whole place is fumigated mm-hmm. and it's done. Yes, most of these people have been traveling and they've come from Africa, but they have not just come from Africa to Malta. They've had a transition moment in Libya. They've had a transition period in Libya. And so they did not just carry malaria genes or whatever, for lack of better words, mm-hmm. into Malta. Are there concerns of health issues? Yes. But even HIV, there hasn't been any significant increase in the number of HIV cases that have come to Malta. Yes, they have had... We have had migrants who have had HIV, because, of course, traveling through this, you know, traveling through the desert and going to Libya and leaving their family behind, they've had a very active sex life and sometimes unprotected. But at the Massa Open Center, I can tell you that we don't have more than, what, two or three cases of, and these people are now out of Malta. They have been resettled in other countries, and they have had treatment. So there is no scare, there's no health risk.
Okay, now one other factor. In an open center like Marsa, mm-hmm. you have people coming from different nationalities. Many Maltese, unfortunately, tend to see them simply as coming from Africa. All right, therefore they're all the same, but they aren't. So I would imagine that racial, religious tensions, to some extent or other, do exist. And if they do, how do you try to diffuse them?
I would even go further and saying that it is not the tensions between nationalities, but it is again the tensions between the peoples. Mm-hmm. When people feel rejected, they group and they form a common identity. Each nationality in Massa Open Center, they form communities, and these communities give support. They have their own elders, they have their own leaders, they have their own they recreate what they used to have back home here. So tensions as such between nationalities, let's say Ghanaians, Ivorians, Eritreans and Somalians, does not exist. Because of this factor that they are not here to live here, so they create this artificial African community. But you do find tensions within the same nationalities who are from different tribes, because what happens back home reverberates here. And they spend their life watching satellite TV. They spend their life watching the programs back home, which is refeeding every day whatever happens back home here, because they feel we are not wanted here, so they reconnect back home. So you do find tensions between Somalian tribes, between Ishag, Hawiya. If there's any fight, you will find that it's between two people of the same nationality. But between the nations themselves, they don't. So again...
And on religious basis, do you have tension?
No. Because a majority of the people here are Muslim.
Okay, so, Professor Proto mentioned the religious basis, and we still have only 4 or 5 minutes, and I would like to come to this topic while apologizing, perhaps in the recording, our listeners will listen to some noises because there is work.
It's your heart
being
heard.
And we could not avoid it. You said that most of them are Muslim people, but you are here, and you are the senior pastor of the new
Life
Christian Center, Knesia Christiana Evangelica, mm-hmm. and also the chairman of the Malta Pentecostal Council.
You used to be,
yes. So you are not longer. But is the pastor of the Pentecostal Church and the New Life Christian Center the same church?
Yes. I mean, each church for the purpose of registration has a name. Mm-hmm. And so then the name identifies each congregation. Mm-hmm. As you know, within the evangelical movement, the concept of the autonomy of the local church mm-hmm. is emphasized. So we have no hierarchical system as we have in the Roman Catholic Church. So each church is autonomous and yet dependent on the other churches. Mm-hmm. So the Pentecostal Council was supposed to gather all the other mm-hmm. pastors of all the other churches. So
what kind of community do you have?
New Life Christian Center is a church on its own. Mm-hmm. And a majority of the people who used to be in Evangelica were Maltese. Right now, because of my work at Massa, most of the mm-hmm. people in our community are migrants. We have over 16 different nationalities gathered in our services every Sunday and Wednesday.
How many people?
We have between 60 and 80 people mm-hmm. every Sunday. But we have more, sometimes less, because of work, mm-hmm. commitment and things. But
so
all together...
It's a small community, a couple of hundreds perhaps?
Yes, but all together... Together, there are about 12 Pentecostal churches mm-hmm. in Malta, mm-hmm. some of them mainly Maltese, mm-hmm. especially those ones in Orme.
We're being pushed for time, and our technician is getting jitters. I can see him mm-hmm. over there. Let me ask you this question. If you had to tell me what you would like to see changed at the Mars Open Center, changed as quickly as possible, what would that be?
Infrastructure and security. I think that we're struggling in these two areas. The Mata Open Center was built as a school. It was put up very quickly as a place of temporary accommodation. It has become a permanent accommodation for many people. So the structure of the sanitary conditions are not desirable. So that is what I am looking at changing very, very quickly. Fortunately, government is willing to consider our proposals to do some upgrading of the infrastructure. I have discussions with the ministry on this. The second is security. Because the place was never looked at as a place of permanent accommodation, mm-hmm. Mars Open Center have had every other person come and live there. And at the moment, it is a security challenge. Mm-hmm. So we need to put a proper exit access control system where we have our residents and we have the visitors. And that these are the two things that we're working on immediately. And also a response, that in case we have any activities which are not good, then the police can act very, very quickly to quiet it down. But we cannot just leave Masa Open Center to exist, as to speak, as someone has said, as a human container for African people. I think that causes problems.
Okay, daw il-kommenti, niġu fit-tmim dan il-program jien, Father Joe Borch, fil-kien il-professor Joe Perotar. Nirringrazzjaw il-mistident għana l-Ahmed Zanja Bukri tal-risposti tiegħu u tal-informazzjoni tagħna. Nirringrazzjaw lilkom l-attenzjoni tagħkom waqt li nagħmlu appuntament għall-bħallu ġimgħa saħħa.
Għadkom kem smajtu? Mhux kelma bejtnej, l-intervista tal-Bank of Valletta. Produzzjoni u prezentazzjoni ta' Father Joe Borch u l-Professur Joe Perotta. Program li għadkom kem smajtu kim iġjub li l-kom bix-xewqa tajba tal-Bank of Valletta.